And I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and I believe that they should, our education over here.
That's where our public resources should be, our public priority, with time and resources spent on that, not on this superficial, wasteful political blood sport. So may we all learn from them.
Miss Teen Alaska there, struggling mightily with her personal statement. Honestly, Sarah Palin's speech, and I use that word flexibly, is not as incoherent on a micro level, you know, word by word, as it is when you listen to the whole thing, which just adds up to a giant, what are you talking about? Nobody knows. Our listeners don't know, but they know how to write a crafty limerick about the situation. We've been bombarded with Palin poetry this week, and we're going to share some of those with you later. This is In the Loop. Of course, I'm Jeff Horwich. Thanks for grabbing the podcast. While Sarah Palin was stumbling off the stage, this week also had a few good comeback stories to balance things out. General Motors, just moments ago as I'm speaking, flashed across my screen, has the green light from a judge now to come out of bankruptcy. The way they're going to do this is by technically selling all of the assets of the company to a new company, which may, people have speculated, have a new name, which might not be a bad idea because General Motors is a dumb name. And some time ago, we asked listeners on Facebook to suggest new names for this new company. And here are a few of those. Laura says maybe turn around since they're paring down the product line, perhaps, from General Motors. Call it Specific Motors now because they're just, you know, selling what'll make money, one would think. Ben says call it Federal Automotive. That's self-explanatory. From Chris, UAW Motor Company. Because, and I'm speculating on the reasons here, at least maybe you ought to give the workers something, right? Brian says, I'll just call it Saturn. And here's my favorite, actually, from Sarah. Keep the initials, GM, but they now stand for Giant Mulligan. Very nice. Another comeback story, Lance Armstrong, of course, fighting for the lead in the Tour de France. And while Lance has unretired one time, he's got nothing on the unretiringest sports guy of them all, who now looks like he's bringing his aging shoulder to my neck of the woods here, and people are either screaming or swooning.
Brett Favre's gonna be a Viking.
Let that lovely metallic reverb die out. What do Brett Favre and the Beach Boys have in common? The letter B, I guess. That's all the reason I needed. I know there are vitriolic Favre haters out there, many of you, but I'm excited. I was born in Wisconsin, so I've always had kind of like this Brett Favre thing, and I've lived in Minnesota now for 8 years, and I've been looking for some reason to give a flying rotator cuff about the Vikings, and now maybe I have one. I should just say, this is not like confirmed, but Brett and his wife did put down a deposit on a condo in the burbs here, and these days, ain't nobody moving to Edina, Minnesota, unless you got a good-paying job. Know what I'm saying? And I guess that does it for today's edition of In the Loop Sports News. Turning now to more serious and significant events of the world, there are new protests just today, as a matter of fact, in Iran. And that comes after a bit of a lull, but students are back out on the streets despite explicit threats from the government that they'll be smashed if they do that, shouting provocative things like death to the dictator. We, that is to say, Sandin, my producer, and I have been poking around Iranian blogs trying to see if we can find some new and interesting voices to engage on all this. And one that really caught our attention is called Neo Resistance. It's written, of all things, by a radiologist who lives in Canada. Her name is Naj. She grew up in Iran. She left in 1991, but goes back pretty frequently. She posts videos and music related to what's going on there. But most of all, she's got a lot of just passionate, challenging, and I would say complex thoughts about Iran and how things are playing out. Now, we're just going to call her Naj, her first name, because she does go back from time to time and would rather not be a target, naturally. Naj, thanks very much for taking a little bit of time to talk with us.
My pleasure.
Where do you put yourself, just so we can get to know you a little bit, on the Iranian political spectrum?
I consider myself a nationalist. And whoever and whatever is serving the best interests of my country, then they are the ones that I side with.
So where do you come down on the events that are transpiring right now?
Well, what is happening right now, I mean, what has appalled me is the violence that's taken place against innocent people who are protesting. You know, they're not sure about the results of the election, and they're challenging it, and I do not think this challenge needs to be addressed with batons and with bullets. And the fact that the government has chosen to sort of oppose one of their own in the way that they have, Mr. Mousavi, he's a very religious, very conservative man. The fact that they have launched such an assault on him is quite amazing. It's something that I think nobody expected to see.
A lot of people in the U.S., I think, whether they're more conservative or more liberal on the American political spectrum, are rooting for some kind of big change in Iran, something that kind of brings Americans together. They all want to see, you know, something big happen here, and they're turning their Facebook, you know, profile pictures and Twitter profile pictures green and all that. What do you make of Americans' hopes?
Well, Iranians, they have grown up with this paranoia about the foreign involvement. So they're trying to keep this movement as independent as they want. And sometimes, from what I'm reading, they're frustrated by things that a lot of Iranian-American community, for example, is saying. But I think the best thing that can happen for Iran is if the Americans just stay alert to what is happening in Iran, but then at the same time keep their eyes on their own government and on statements such as those made by Mr. Biden recently on Sunday, you know, giving the green light to Israel to attack Iran.
He's known for saying things that don't necessarily represent the official point of view.
Well, he insisted on that. But what is important is that I do not think a big revolution is going to happen in Iran. I don't think anybody in Iran wants a big change. And I think people in Iran are quite aware of the external threat that exists on Iran. The slightest nod, such as those given by Mr. Biden, is enough to sort of make people retract from this march towards democracy that they have begun and throw their support behind the government because the land goes before democracy in Iran.
You mentioned something a moment ago that I want to follow up on. You said, I don't think anybody in Iran wants a big change. What do you mean by that?
A big change? I don't think so. I think Iranians have had their experience with a big revolution, with a complete, you know, change of the system. And they have realized that change doesn't come overnight. And Iranians think that they have to reform. Right now, what's been happening is that Ahmadinejad has been mismanaging the country. It's mostly the economy of the country that has been messing up. And this is what has made people very angry. The social liberties and the civic liberties, it's another issue, but I think it's not essential. And of course, there are some people in Iran who are more radical and they're fed up with this regime. But I do not think that they are the majority.
I want to ask about a post you had on your blog, something about Iranians sort of withdrawing into themselves and into religious study and into kind of quiet time as a form of protest. What's the phenomenon that's happening there?
Yeah, this recent post that I made, it's about etikaf. So etikaf is a religious exercise of basically taking some time off, staying in a mosque and doing nothing other than studying Quran and religious texts. And this is one of those acts of resistance that has been advocated by some of these green groups in the past few days, basically taking refuge into mosques where they cannot be beaten and they cannot be dragged out and branded as anarchists.
But if people are leaving the streets, if, you know, the movement in its big flashy sense is fading and people are retiring into this sort of quiet form of protest, what good does that do?
I think it is going to be more effective in the long run. People being on the streets, I do not think it's going to bring the government down, and they're just changing their mode of resistance. I think the fact that the government has sort of successfully put people back into their houses, it's again one of those things they need to show this powerful hand, because as I said, you know, Iran is, at the same time that it has internal problems, it's facing external enemies. I mean, there is the United States and Israel, who are every other day issuing bombing threats on Iran and its peaceful nuclear energy development. And these are things that, you know, ordinary people in Iran are actually supportive of.
And it sounds like you're supportive of it as well.
Yes, yes, I am. I'm absolutely supportive of that. I don't think anybody has any business telling Iran what kind of a technology it wants to develop. And I don't think Iran is after atomic bomb, but even if it is, so what? All its neighbors have one. Mm-hmm. And it is to prevent the country from being bullied by the Russians and Chinese and Pakistanis and Israelis and, you know, who else. So if people sense external threat, then they would voluntarily pull back to their homes. And I think this is one of the things that people have done.
There's been a lot of fuss made about how hard it is to get information into and out of Iran. Does it feel that way to you? Like it's some kind of information lockdown?
Yes, it does. You cannot contact people that you know and then get information from them because some of the people that you know are being under surveillance. When you call an uncle who's telling you that, you know, we are supporters of Ahmadinejad, then you know that you have to shut the hell up and not ask any more questions. So, yes, it is difficult, but then at the same time, Iranians are used to circumventing censorship. If anything, they are the best filter breakers of the world.
I have to ask you, I guess, the ultimate neurotic American question, which is if I were to go to Iran and just walk around the street talking to people, what's my status as the great Satan?
I think you would be greeted by people on the street in a friendly manner because Iranians are very hospitable. And forget about all those chants of down with America. It really is just a slogan. It doesn't mean much.
Wow, that's a distinction that...
you do not go to Iran right now.
Oh, well,
because they might take your camera if nothing
can. I don't have the money or the invitation at the moment to go to Iran.
Yeah.
But... to say that it's just a slogan, I mean, of course, it's hard to wrap my head around because the slogan is still out there, but people don't believe it?
No, you see, this is the paradox again. The Iranian politics seem to have been tied to the American one, not only because of the oil, but also because of the way different American parties are playing against each other vis-a-vis, you know, the Iranian problem. So in that sense, that paranoia is there. But there is no hatred for Americans as individuals or as a country.
Well, Naj, I know you're traveling doing research for your work, and we caught up with you in Europe. Thanks very much for taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you very much for your interest.
Naj's blog is called Neo Resistance, and you can find it at iranfacts.blogspot.com. Speaking of resistance movements, many of you probably have seen these crazy pictures from Western China, mobs of ethnic Han Chinese squaring off against mobs of Uyghurs, who are this Muslim ethnic group that isn't generally crazy about being a part of China. And people are carrying sticks and bats and like pitchforks and torches. It's like gangs of Urumqi. Funny timing, because we actually did a song about Uyghurs for the show a couple of weeks ago. Uyghur prisoners from Guantanamo who were being relocated to tropical islands. Apparently, Uyghurs really dig the song because the video got posted to the website of the Uyghur American Association, and a bunch of Uyghur folks left friendly comments on YouTube. Now, we don't have a lot of Uyghur contacts, surprise, surprise, but we thought we would try, just for the heck of it, the somewhat improbable notion of trying to reach the people who had left those comments on our YouTube video. Seemed like kind of a long shot, YouTube being what it is, but... just this morning, Sandin finally got a hold of a guy named Erkin, who lives in the Netherlands. And he was just coming back when Sandin reached him from helping get some of his friends out of jail, where they'd been taken after a Uyghur protest there in The Hague evidently turned ugly. Because of his family in China, Erkin only wanted to give us his first name. Here is just a bit of what he had to say.
I am very glad we are heard finally by the world. It's better than what happened in 97. Thousands of Uyghurs fled, hundreds of Uyghurs were killed, and it wasn't heard. This time, for some reason, it is heard, but I am very sad about, I heard more than 700-800 Uyghurs were killed. On the BBC and CNN mostly, we can only hear what the Chinese government says, and Chinese government announced only 150 people were killed. Our situation is worse than the situation of Tibet, because Tibet is under the eye of the world. Tibet have got Dalai Lama, who was able to reach the public, let the international community heard of the problems of Tibet. And also superstars like Richard Gere, they helped support Tibet. But for us, our news didn't go to the Western media. And if the Western media and America don't hear, it doesn't really count.
All right, that was Erkin. He's a Uyghur living in The Hague, Netherlands. None of the other Uyghurs who commented on our YouTube video got back to us, but we're glad that he did. And of course, I don't know better than anybody else who's telling the truth about the number of deaths from the race riots in Urumqi, China, or the Uyghur community. President Obama, you know, spent much of his week in Asia, hoping to push the reset button or do a reboot or whatever phrase he used, press control alt delete on our relationship with Russia. That was unlikely to happen, and it didn't, really. Russian media didn't cover the Obama family's arrival or their departure. They didn't carry his speech or news conferences live. There's a lot of recent history there to work through. According to a new poll, Russians consider America their second biggest enemy after Georgia, which really, Georgia's so tiny that I think, as in so many things, we're number one. Russia's paper president and its actual president were welcoming enough, but they didn't give Obama much to bring home. So what do you do when the world seems at an impasse like this? Well, you put yourself in the other fellow's shoes. And while you're there, if you're me, you write a song about it.
Well, how very, very nice of you to visit. It has been so long, there's so much to talk about. Yes, we were pals back in the day, but somewhere along the way, we decided that we hate you. But perhaps we worked things out. Think back, 20 years ago, we used to love you. Oh, how we wanted to be like the USA. But then you don't forgive our debt, and you expect us to forget that you go on expanding NATO as if Russia's still a threat. Come on, no one takes Russia for granted. You are reaping exactly what you planted. Give a speech, I don't care. Don't think I'll put that on the air. You're very good at speechy-speechy. That won't make things Georgia peachy. We can talk military cooperation. Okay. We can both reduce our nukes. Yes, that makes sense. But don't hold out any hope to get your hands on Osteuropa, and you'd better move those missiles you keep poking up our zopa. That means but. Understand, we dislike you immensely. It's just kind of a thing with us now. If you thought you could ignore us, here's a hefty Russian chorus saying, who you think you're messing with? Natasha and Boris. Yet, no one takes Russia for granted. We're very sensitive, and you know we just can't stand it. Just because we let one guy stay in charge until he died doesn't mean we don't have feelings and we don't know how to cry. And foreign policy aside, don't you know you hurt our pride? You did. Thanks for stopping. Nice to visit. Now please go back to your side.
Well, I haven't done a song in a Russian accent since Russia invaded Georgia back in August. Yeah, every 11 months or so, that seems like plenty. As seems to be our usual habit, there's a video of this song being recorded. Mandolin, melodica, crazy face I make when I'm doing a Russian accent and all. You can find that at intheloopshow.net, our main webpage, or loopfacebook.net. I may throw it on YouTube as well if you want to look for it there. This is In the Loop, an old radio habit. I don't even need to remind you as a podcast listener of that fact, but there you have it. This is In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. And now we've come to the portion of our show where we like to check in with someone out there. Maybe they're a listener. Maybe they're just somebody else that we know who happens to follow some area of the news, their news niche, you might say, much more closely than you or I. And today, we're going to talk airlines with a guy who calls himself a Cranky Flyer, writes a blog at crankyflyer.com. Brett Snyder, thanks very much for coming on In the Loop.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys.
You like flying, right? And you're into airplanes since you've been a little kid.
I don't always like flying.
Okay, like that's true. I asked you two questions there.
But since I was a little kid, I have called myself a proud airline dork. Used to run, you know, terminal-to-terminal collecting timetables. So.
And you brought a number of sort of headlines that we're going to work through here. Let's start with Ryanair, which, as I recall, is often kind of on the vanguard of sort of trying new things out. What's their idea this time?
You know, they're the ultra-low-cost carrier of Europe that pioneered a lot of these things that people complain about today. these extra fees and things like that. And it probably also helps that their CEO, Michael O'Leary, is a tremendous PR hog. So anything he can do to get in the limelight, he's going to throw it out there. Hmm. The latest from him, I guess there are actually a couple of them. One is that they have announced they want to get rid of checked baggage entirely.
Wait. Okay. How is that? How can that possibly work?
What Ryanair is saying here is, we just don't want to have anyone working outside of security. We basically just want one person to open the door and let you on the plane, and that's about it. So, you know, bring any bags you want, anything you can get through security, anything the government will let you get away with. If you can get it to the plane, we'll either get it in the overhead, under the seat, or we'll have you throw it in the belly yourself.
Really?
That's what he's saying.
Do you believe it? Is this practical?
If he can find a way to do it with the safety and security concerns that are out there, I have to think that he will, because then he can cut more costs. Of course, there's that problem. If you want to bring something on that's more than 100 milliliters, since this is over in Europe, mm-hmm. you know, any liquid that's over 100 milliliters, well, you're out of luck.
And what's the other big idea that they've got for us?
So his other big idea certainly fits in that same vein, standing room only seating. Picture kind of Hannibal Lecter, right, where you get him strapped down to a board like that.
Yeah.
I think it'll be something like that where, you know, they can't just have you holding on, because there are rules about, you know, ability to withstand G-forces and turbulence and all uh-huh. these different things.
So this is what the flying experience will come to, being strapped to a board in the back of a plane for the sake of flying.
It's certainly possible. I actually really like this idea, because right. they don't want to put this on their planes replacing all their seating. They're just saying they want to have an extra cabin. It'll be cheaper. This is for people that really can't afford to travel with what's out there now, and they're willing to stand, then more power to them.
Let's talk about another airline probably few people have ever heard of, called Wizz Air.
Just the name alone is funny, right?
Wizz Air had kind of a gimmick going of some sort that kind of blew up. What happened?
So Wizz Air is based in Hungary. They fly around Eastern Europe. They were celebrating their fifth anniversary, and they had this great idea. They were going to put together a bunch of balloons, and then they were going to put discount certificates in each balloon. They're going to have this big celebration in the center of town, and then release all the balloons to float around Hungary and Eastern Europe, and, you know, wherever they landed, people would get a discount on their next flight.
Sounds magical.
Didn't quite work out as planned. A handful of people started crowding around, and the crowd grew bigger and bigger and bigger. All of a sudden, one person went in there, pulled one of the certificates out for a discount, and then it just became a feeding frenzy, and everyone just went crazy in the crowd, started popping balloons, taking the certificates, doing all this stuff. And apparently Wizz Air didn't even think about this possibility. So people can use as many certificates as they want. So, you know, you have people that are probably going to be flying free for a little while here.
Did they get any balloons into the air at all?
I don't know how many, but from all accounts, it does not appear that this was the most successful promotion around.
And you've got an example for us, something that's playing out right now, of kind of airline complaints in the age of the internet, when these things can go viral. Give us the details on that.
Apparently about a year ago, a guy named Dave Carroll, who's a country singer with a band up in Canada, he was flying on United and checked his guitar, which apparently was about a $3,500 guitar. Got on the plane, was sitting there and watched a ramper throw the guitar around like a little rag doll. When he landed, sure enough, his guitar was broken. So he spent about 9 months with United trying to get some sort of payment for this. And in the end, after 9 months, they basically told him to go away. So he said, okay, I'm going to go write a song about this. And 10 years ago, right, what happens when some guy at a, you know, little-known band in Canada writes a song? Not much. Well, this guy puts it on YouTube. Now we're talking about hundreds of thousands of views. Blogs everywhere have been picking this up. It's blown up. It's gone all over the world now, and everyone knows that apparently United breaks guitars.
Now, if he'd been flying Ryanair, maybe he could throw his own guitar in the hold.
Except Ryanair would probably say, guitar, let's see, that's expensive. We can charge you about, you know, $50 for that.
Or the guitar fee, yeah. Well, Brett, as we let you go here, we'll let people listen to a little bit of United Breaks Guitars. But thanks a lot for taking a few minutes to fill us in on a couple of these things.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
It's Brett Snyder. Check him out at crankyflyer.com.
I flew United Airlines on my way to Nebraska. The plane departed Halifax, connecting in Chicago's O'Hare. While on the ground. ground, a passenger said from the seat behind me, "My God, they're throwing guitars out there." The band and I exchanged a look, best described as terror, at the action on the tarmac, and knowing whose projectiles these would be. So before I left Chicago, I alerted three employees who showed complete indifference towards me. United, United, you broke my Taylor guitar.
The singer and United. Aggrieved customer of United Airlines is Dave Carroll. The band is called Sons of Maxwell. So, as you may recall, I promised you Palin poetry before all was said and done here, and so I'm going to present some of the poetic reflections of our listeners on the sudden departure of Sarah Palin, sudden and confusing departure of Sarah Palin, sudden, confusing, and awkward departure of Sarah Palin from the Alaska governorship. We did receive a number of longer, beautiful, well-crafted examples of poetry from people, including a great one from a guy named Chris Kemp, who wrote it, he said, with his wife, Lori. And I liked it so much, posted it on our blog at intheloopshow.net. So please check that out. The longer stuff we've learned from experience is a little difficult to present on the show, especially if you're trying to get a range of voices here. So what we're going to do is focus on one particular style of poetry that a number of people embraced for some reason or another when it came to Sarah Palin, and that is the limerick. So let's start with Jamie Steele. Jamie is in Atlanta, Georgia. Jamie, take it away.
There was a Governor Allen. Her name was Sarah Palin. She thought an act would win them back, so she quit her job instead of Phelan.
Thanks, Jamie. And now on to a limerick from a fellow named Guthrie Horgan, whom I've never met, but he stands out in my memory because I remember seeing at one point his Facebook profile picture was him picking his nose, which maybe is a nice representation of the cerebral approach to poetry that we take here at In the Loop. Guthrie sent us like five poems and all kinds of different things this week, and then we couldn't hear back from him, so Guthrie, I'm going to read your limerick, if that's okay with you. Alaska is losing S. Palin. Her public life now, she is Balin. Oh, where will she shelve her things till 012? Shooting moose, or perhaps she's out whaling. Thank you, Guthrie Horgan. And now on to Dan O'Klanowski, who is here in the Twin Cities, I believe. He of the four dozen or so snarky in-the-loop slogan suggestions from a few weeks ago, with a short poem, which is not, I realize now, a limerick, actually, not only hitting on the Palin thing, but a few other stories in the news and not in the news.
Palin resigns in a shroud of mystery. McNamara passes in the fog of war. iTunes sales are up for bad thriller in history, and single-payer health care is talked of no more.
Thank you, Dano, and thanks to everybody who sent in poems to us over the last few days about Sarah Palin and all kinds of other news topics. Our editorial process is mysterious. There's no getting around it. But we try to spread the love around a little bit. And, you know, they don't all have to be this short, of course. But shorter is generally better. Just keep that in mind. If you have ideas for news poems about anything, send them to us at our website, intheloopshow.net. You'll find a little link there to do it. In the Loop is produced by Sandin Totten and by me here at Minnesota Public Radio. And what do you know? We're clocking in under a half hour. That's what happens when you do them every week, which is what we are going to try to do from now on. And so I will leave you with just one short closing thought. Is anybody else noticing that when you reprimand your child or your dog, you're beginning to sound like Barack Obama? I don't think it's just me. Every time it comes out of my mouth, nope, nope, get off the counter, nope, don't chew on that, nope. Listen to yourself closely next time. I bet you'll hear it too. I'm Jeff Horwich with a very quick request. If you're digging In the Loop, tell a friend or two or 10, or write it on your blog, or tweet about it, or write us up a short review on iTunes. You, my friends, are our golden marketing machine, and we love you for it. I will talk to you next week.